STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, friends, my turn here. Greg Kokel. I caught the enforcer asleep at the switch there. She was enjoying the music, but forgot to give me my mic. Greg Kokel, host of Stand to Reason. And, I do not love radio. Some people absolutely love doing radio. It's not the love of my life, but I tell you what, it is a powerful way to make a difference, and that is a love of my life. And so it's a pleasure in that regard to be able to engage in the back and forth. Takes a lot of focus, a lot of concentration. Maybe that's part of the issue here. So it's not just like a joyride. But after 27 years, let me just see. Today's the 7th. It's February 11th, I think, is our anniversary. So we're just, my anniversary. So that will be 27 years, the beginning of the 28th year. All right. And wanted to get some callers on board here. I'll get to them in just a moment. But I did want to say something about the Boy Scouts. Oh, my goodness gracious. I love the Boy Scouts. I was a Boy Scout myself. I love what they stand for. I love what they have done. I love the salutary effect that they have been in the lives of young men. I love the way they have produced young men of virtue and of character. And I know that that this is still their desire, but it's been painful for me over the years to watch them be hamstrung by political correctness and what I think are vacuous and foolish appeals to equality and complaints of discrimination. I have said this since the very beginning of the conflict with the Boy Scouts. I've been on the air 27 years, so this goes back a while, when they first started getting beaten up for being Boy Scouts who care about living a morally straight life. Now, this morally straight language came long before straight had anything to do with sexual preference, all right? That means people who were virtuous and true. Look at the concept of virtue has substance. It has content. It isn't just whatever. They stand in a tradition, a long tradition of noble, virtuous character training. And so they have pledges. I was a Cub Scout first, then a Boy Scout. They have pledges and they have mottos. Do a good deed daily. Listen, the word good isn't any old thing. It means something specific. It has to be morally right. That means you can't be a moral relativist and keep the motto. Well, maybe that's not the motto. Maybe that's the something else. There's also be prepared. Maybe that's another motto, but they may call it something else. But you get my point. They have these little aphorisms that the young men are supposed to memorize and seek to have them be part of their lives. And this is so successful in what it did that it spawned the Girl Scouts, who had some kind of similar goals. I don't know much about them because I wasn't one of them. But they're probably now best known for their cookies, I guess. But these are noble enterprises, and they have been progressively hamstrung by the politically correct crowd who are not improving anything a single bit. What they are doing is undermining and destroying something that is good. As some have said, look, if you want, a Gay Scouts of America, then start your own organization. with your different set of goals. No, they've become the whipping boy of the left now for a long, long time. And frankly, they're buckling. Well, they have buckled. Here a piece from Katie Zazima, The Washington Post, January 30th. Boy Scouts of America will allow transgender children to join. This is an information piece. It's not an editorial piece. No reflection here on Katie Zazima. And if I'm pronouncing her name right, it just tells us what's going on. The Boy Scouts of America announced Monday that it will allow transgender children to enroll in scouting programs. In other words, it's no longer the Boy Scouts. Oh, yes, these people believe they're boys, but they're not boys. They are not boys in the sense that the Boy Scouts mean boys when they made the Boy Scouts. All right? It's no longer Boy Scouts of America. I'm surprised now that, now I think about it, somebody hasn't been offended by the word America. Because maybe we're discriminating. Of course, the Boy Scouts as an organization is worldwide now. Is that successful? But maybe this would be considered discriminatory. The point that I made early on when all of this started to happen, when they started to come under attack, and then they were vilified by the press, and therefore then increasingly disqualified for participation in community lives, using facilities and stuff like that. The evil Boy Scouts. I actually read, I don't have it in front of me, I used to have it memorized, but I forgot, the list of virtues that they committed themselves to. This is the evil group, the Boy Scout group. What is the list of virtues that gay people have as a group committed themselves to? The LGBT crowd has committed themselves to. Where is that list of virtues that they pledge to follow? I'll tell you one thing. One of them's not tolerance, because they don't tolerate anybody that's not like them in terms of their views and ideas, et cetera, et cetera. In any event, that's a different issue. Point is, the Boy Scouts were a noble organization, and then they started getting attacked. It's crazy. And little by little, they got chipped away. Boom, boom, boom. And finally, they made a concession. They conceded, and they say, okay, gays can be part of the Boy Scouts. Gay young men can be part of the Boy Scouts. Now, this is a huge mistake in my view, and I said so at the time. I thought, this is an appeasement, and do you think this appeasement is going to satisfy the left? This appeasement is not going to satisfy the left. I said that at the time. This is years ago. And sure enough, the ink was not even dry on the documentation that said, okay, we will abandon our ideas of morally straight and virtue, at least in one arena. And we will accept gays as members of the Boy Scout, that is, practicing gays as members of the Boy Scouts. The ink wasn't even dry before the left was demanding that they have leadership that were gay as well. You think that throwing them the bone of allowing gay boys in the Boy Scouts was going to satisfy them? No. They immediately demanded more. And so they appeased eventually and gave in. So now you have gay young men in a young men's group camping together, showering together, doing all manner of things together, and gay leaders doing the same with all the young men. Now look at, need I say more? I mean, this is so counterintuitive, right? Nevertheless, this is what happened. But they weren't satisfied. Here's a principle right here. You will not be able to satisfy the left in these kinds of things. You will never be able to satisfy them. This kind of thing will not end until there is complete and abject and total surrender to everything the left demands. They have a totalitarian impulse. It isn't may the best idea win. It isn't for the right, that is the right, the good. It is for what they want, and if what they want goes against the principles that they argued for one thing, then they will change their principles. I've seen it time and time. The left is for the left, period. It is not for what is right. All right. Now, my view has always been this. The best way to deal with a bully is to stand up to him or her. And in a certain sense, metaphorically speaking, so there's no confusion here, knock them down. You got to say no to bullies. If you don't say no to bullies, they just taste blood and go further. And this is an example of it. You think that this is the end of it? No, because now they demand, well, like I've already told you, the pressure has been to accept transgendered. So now Boy Scouts have to take girls. Maybe some of them Boy Scouts don't mind so much, I guess. Nevertheless, and I have a question to ask the left on this issue. Is gender based on objective criteria, or is gender completely subjective? Now, it's a trick question. Columbo number 3. Not that I'm trying to trick them at all, but I'm trying to tell me, I know what they're going to have to say, but I'm going to use it against them. That's the trick. It isn't tricking them into saying something they don't mean. They believe gender is something completely subjective. All right? It is not objective. Objective gender is binary. Subjective gender is anything nowadays. So it's subjective. Okay, then what would be wrong with me saying that based on my subjective assessment that all boys with male genitalia are also male-gendered? Do you see the move here? They want to say, well, gender is completely subjective. It's up to anybody's individual feelings. Okay, well, you feel that you with male genitalia are a girl, and I'm not, you know, I can be accused of being unsympathetic to people who are struggling with this. That's not what's going on here. But I'm just dealing with trying to the issue itself. Okay, if it's then why can't I decide that you're a boy or a girl? Why can't for me you are this other gender? Why can't everybody have their own subjective assessment of everything around them? Why is it that you're the only one who gets to make that decision for you? I'm a subject, but you want me to accept your assessment of yourself. Why can't I just accept my own assessment? See, the rules are different for different people. And they say, well, then it's because it's me. It's my own assessment of myself. And I say, so what? This is all about feelings, right? I have my feelings about my world. Why don't those count? All right, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, I saw a cover story in National Geographic going through the airport. It's all on gender. So here's this group of people with all these different genders, and they have little call-outs for the different genders of these different people. Now, what occurred to me immediately is, what does gender issues have to do with National Geographic? It doesn't have anything to do with geography. And I know it's anthropology, too, and paleontology and Darwinism and stuff like that. But minimally, it has to do with science, right? But clearly, there's nothing even remotely scientific about gender stuff, because it has nothing whatsoever to do with the way the world objectively is. Because the objective world, the world as it is in itself, I mean, apart from people's thinking, the world, for human beings, sex is binary. You got males and females. There are very unusual, very, 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 very rare exceptions. But on balance, okay, male and female, all right? The gender distinctions are all in the mind, which is something to remember when somebody tells you, yes, but gender is very fluid. Gender could be anything. Just keep in mind that when they say that, They are simply saying what people can conjure up in their own minds. They are not talking about physical reality. In fact, I don't know why physicalist types, materialist types, atheist types are on board with this at all, because that deals with something that's not even part of reality. Reality is a physical stuff. Physical stuff is male and female for human beings. You can't be a woman in a man's body in a materialistic view of the world, because there is no difference. There is no woman inside even a female body. There's just a female body in a physicalistic world, right? And so this whole idea of a man inside a woman's body or vice versa, do you see how this is all subtly dualistic? Well, that would be, you'd have to have a soul for that to happen, and that's not materialistic. That isn't, doesn't fit that worldview. So that it kind of is a curiosity. Maybe there are some atheistic materialists that are pushing back against this because it is subtly hostile to their own worldview, but I haven't heard of it yet. Just keep in mind, and I'll just offer this parting thought, don't be intimidated when scientists even tell you that gender is fluid. Because now they're not talking about science if science is limited to the physical world. They're just talking about people's preferences, their imaginations, what they might want to call identity. But, you know, even this gender identity kind of stuff, this isn't identity in a stricter sense, because it changes. People with gender confusion early on in life oftentimes resolve this confusion by the time they're done with puberty. It happens even without any help, any intervention of any kind at all. That's what's in their minds. And on that basis, all kinds of things can be said to be true, all kinds of fantasies and fictions and imaginary things. Saying gender is fluid is like, sounds like a statement of fact about science, but it's not. All it means is that people are capable of thinking about themselves in a wide variety of ways. This doesn't mean that we're to be unkind to those people or not take their self-perception seriously, but we don't have to take the... We can take it seriously as a self-perception. We don't have to take it seriously as a bona fide gender distinction. Our minds can conjure up all kinds of distinctions. That does not mean that we are describing anything about the way the world is, only about how people think about themselves. So don't be blinded by so-called science in this regard. And as I said, I don't see, if you're going to play the subjective card, I don't see why, on their view of reality, anyone should be forced to accept their own subjective view of themselves rather than letting everyone define reality the way they subjectively want to. So that's another issue. Anyway, let's take a break. Come back to your calls after this on Stand to Reason.
Students, who's waiting for you? Parents, pastors, who is waiting for your students? When they leave the safety of your home or your church, who will they encounter? What kind of challenges will they face? The fact is that the majority of our young people are not ready for the intellectual and moral challenges they'll face, not only on the college campus, but on the high school campus or junior high campus, and that is why they need to go to Rethink. Bring your students to the Rethink Apologetics Student Conference in Birmingham, Alabama on April 21st and 22nd. Go to rethinkapologetics.com for more information.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like.
friends. Let's go to our callers now, and in Lancaster, California. That's a high desert. Hey, Matt, Lancaster's windy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Man alive, I got blown off the face of the earth when I was there last time. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah. Today I was driving over to Santa Clarita, and the wind was, like, shaking the car the whole way.
Oh, I know, man. So you live there, right?
I do, yes.
All right. Well, all right. Good for you.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
I have two brother-in-laws who try to call into Santa Reason. I think you might have spoken to one of them, whose name was Lincoln, a couple of weeks ago.
All right.
Yeah,
Lincoln, I've been thinking.
They're young guys. They're like 16 and 13. Well, they're very interested and apologetic. And I just said, hey, check out Greg Kokel. So they've been eating your stuff up.
Well, thank you. So you're the one who led them on to us, huh?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind today, Matt?
It's actually been a while since I've called Santa Reason. The last time I called might have been 2 years ago.
Okay.
And the question I asked then was just resources on like reform thinking and salvation.
Uh-huh.
And so that's been keeping me pretty busy.
Oh.
Now, my life hasn't been revolving only around that, but I've been keeping busy with reading and listening to podcasts, things like that. And I want to get your recommendation on maybe resources or books on eschatology. I know you might have mentioned a book that you read one time in a call I heard back maybe years ago, but I don't recall what it was. And I know there's a lot of divergence on this particular issue, not necessarily like heaven or hell eschatology, but like end times,
sure,
like the millennium and that kind of thing.
Right, right. Well, I have a couple of thoughts on that. The liability for me is that this is not an area that I'm interested in, partly because I think that, and I do have a view that is somewhat loosely held. I am, you know, dispensational, and I am premillennial. I'm not pre-trib, though. But I don't fuss too much about it because I know there are differences of opinion and I don't know all the ins and outs of every view. It just seems to me that the promises made in the Old Testament to national Israel are so clear and understood to be to national Israel by the people to whom they were given. So sound hermeneutics identifies this as it's got to be a feature of your eschatology. And so I do think that God still has a special place for the nation of Israel. Some people might say, well, that means God has two, there are two peoples of God. And but my response would be, well, yeah, in a sense. And I don't know how you can avoid that, frankly. There is one church, obviously, in which there is no distinction between, between Jew and Gentile, but there were promises made to national Israel that I think were obviously made to them, and they have not been fulfilled. So it's another issue. I don't want to argue the point, but I'm just giving you a loose idea where I'm at, okay? And I'm trying to think of the kinds of books that influence me the most. There is a plethora of stuff out there hold on just a minute. I just thought of another name. Jotting it down so I don't forget it. There's a plethora of books out there supporting the kind of the Hal Lindsey kind of end times scenario. The Calvary Chapel, Dallas Theological Seminary, Talbot kind of approach. And so I don't need to recommend any of those books because there's a lot of those out there, okay? Except for to say that I was most taken with I took a course with Robert Soucy, S-A-U-C-Y, on what is a kind of dispensationalism, modified dispensationalism, and it was really, really helpful. I'm trying to remember if he has actually written on this. I know he wrote a book called The Church, I think it's called The Church in God's Program, and he might flesh those ideas out a little bit in that book. So, but his name is Robert Soucy, S-A-U-C-Y. Went to be with the Lord few years ago, just a dear man. I had a wonderful time with him. I had my class with him the very last semester that I was in grad school there, and I needed the class, and I wrote him a note. It was already full, And I said, I need this class. Plus, I've been here for, 13 years working through a master's degree, and I cannot leave Talbot without having taken a class from the wonderful Robert Soucy. And I was entirely genuine, and he let me in the class. And in fact, we would meet after the class. I go up to his office and we have chats and conversations. But he has some good things to say about the dispensational view that dictates a certain type of end-time scenario, premillennial view. And so I would recommend his writings to you. Like I said, The Church and God's Program or something like that may be the book that I was using. But you might just check the titles that he's responsible for. On the other side, Kim Riddlebarger has written a book on amillennialism, which I own but I haven't read. Kim, an early teacher of mine some 30 years ago, I'll actually be on the radio with him in a couple of weeks with Mike Horton and the rest of the gang on the White Horse Inn. And Kim's a thoughtful guy. I don't hold his view on this, but I'd commend his book to you if you want to get a good characterization, a thoughtful characterization of the amillennial view. I know Hank Hanegraaff has written a book about it as well, but I don't know anything about that book. I just know that it was somewhat controversial. But I'll just mention that. Okay. I also have two more titles for you that were the two titles that disabused me of my prior belief in a pre-trib rapture. All right. And those were really helpful, very thoughtful books. The first one was called The Church and the Tribulation, and the author is Robert Gundry, G-U-N-D-R-Y. Actually, his brother is the publisher for Zondervan now. But The Church and the Tribulation, Robert Gundry, and The Blessed Hope by George Eldon Ladd, L-A-D-D, The Blessed Hope. Those two books in combination offered such compelling arguments to me that the idea that the church is going to disappear sometime, maybe 7 years before the visible return of Christ is just a fantasy. It's just not grounded well in Scripture. Maybe I shouldn't call it a fantasy. I don't want to offend anybody, but I completely abandoned the idea after listening to their well-reasoned arguments. So, but that's pretty much all that's on my radar on this issue. I don't really hold to the preterist view. Maybe a partial preterist view has some merit to it, but the full preterists I disagree with entirely. The ones that say basically that all the prophecy concerning the second coming of Christ has already taken place. To which I respond, you mean this is it? We're living in the blessed hope? Couldn't God do any better than this? Anyway. So I think there's some merit to a partial preterist view, and it might be that R.C. Sproul holds that view. Again, I'm not really articulate in it because I don't follow it. My view principally now is, generally speaking, is the interpretation, or rather the fulfillment is the final interpretation. The fulfillment is the final interpretation. You know how many ways this could go? A whole bunch of different ways. And pretty much everybody got the first coming wrong. When we look back now, we can see it. It was all there, but they just got it wrong for a whole lot of reasons. And so I could be wrong in my take on this thing. And to me, it doesn't matter that much because I think the most important thing that matters is that the body of Christ is going to experience a lot of suffering just as it has since its inception. And we win in the end. That's Revelation. We win in the end, okay? And that's the thing we need to fix our hope on. And we need to fix our eyes, though, upon, that's like our eyes on, and we fix our feet on this present earth and being faithful to Christ until he comes, whenever it is he comes and however it is he comes. So this is my approach. I just say, well, whatever. I know my marching orders for now, and however he comes and whenever he comes, I want to be found doing my job at that time. That's my eschatology.
Right.
And part of my concern about the pre-trib view is that people who hold it are taking false security and being rescued. And so they maybe aren't taking, maybe, not all, but some may not be taking their own durability facing a challenging, increasingly challenging and hostile culture seriously. And when I have talked in the past about to people and I've said, you know, I don't believe in the rapture stuff the way it's characterized. I believe in the resurrection, and that's 1 Thessalonians 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. It's all resurrection stuff. 1 Thessalonians 4, rather. I believe in the resurrection, but not the rapture the way you characterize it. And when I say that, if people have a tendency to take seriously what I have to say, then they get, I can see it in their eyes, they get scared. And there's, and then I'm wondering, well, why are you scared? Aren't you prepared? Aren't you ready? Read Matthew 10. Matthew 10, Jesus talks about what will befall Christians, and then he says three times, do not fear them. Do not fear them. Do not fear them. Do not fear them. In three different ways, but it's right there in the text. You can read it. So what I want to be is I want to be ready to face what Jesus describes there in Matthew 10, that Christians from the beginning of our project have had to endure and still today are enduring. And I want to also take Jesus' admonition, do not fear them. Right. So that's that. There you go.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. I pretty much said my deal there. Your turn.
Okay. Yeah, I think it might have been Phil Fernandez. I don't know if you're familiar with him. I don't know what his view on this is, but I think it might have been him one time where he was speaking to his congregation for those who were not firm in what they believed on the millennium to, like, best case scenario, expect the pre-trib, but be prepared for a post-trib. So, if it's true, then that's great, but don't expect that if it's not the case.
Well, I like Phil. He's a funny guy, and he's a great apologist. I actually quote him in the Tactics book because he said something funny, and I wanted to use it. I think he's up in the Seattle area. I'm not sure, but I've heard people say, "Look, I'm pre-trib until the tribulation starts. Then I move immediately to mid-trib, and then halfway through the tribulation, I move immediately to post-trib." Okay, fine, I'm with you there. As long as you're ready for whatever happens, that's it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm really grateful for you, Greg. My poor wife. I have so many books, and I'm talking about getting another bookcase. They have books all over the floor, and most of my books are not on eschatology. You know, they're on theology proper, soteriology, all the rest.
Right, good.
And so I'm just not don't have any background in eschatology proper.
Right.
My church growing up, my grandpa actually pastored and preached, and he said that he never preached the Revelation because it was so difficult. So that's probably why I don't have a whole lot of training or exposure end times.
Right.
I think I heard
once that Chuck Swindoll has never preached through Revelations for the same reason. I could be mistaken about it, but I think you have a point there. Well, there you go, Matt. Hope that helps you out, okay? And I hope that it gives you some more reading to do, and I hope that one of the books you got is The Story of Reality. That's it, friends, for our show. Thanks so much for being part of what we do here. I'm Greg Kokel. Give them heaven. This week.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.